CliffCentral.com.
Hey, David, nice to see you, man.
Nice to be
Let's
you.
Welcome you properly. Give you a fanfare. It's a pleasure to meet you. I mean, I looked at this list of things that you've done in your life, and this is some CV, man. Huh?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, firstly.
Sure, what a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a great journey for me. Done some incredible things, seen some incredible things, travelled a bit, and yeah, I always based myself in South Africa. I think for me is key. You know, I've been overseas, I think 2-3 weeks at most at a time, but you know, I've never ever really wanted to leave South Africa. You know?
Now, what was the kind of the point at which people started to take notice? Was it when you were the head chef at the Saxon?
No, look, I think a couple of things happened. I was actually on radio for about 4 years down in Cape Town, and I had a little, I literally had a minute a day, what they call the gourmet minute.
Oh,
and
wow.
I mean, you know what radio.
That's tough. They expect you to make an impact for 1 minute, right?
Let me just tell you.
What station was this?
It was with KFM.
KFM. They wanted you to talk about something for a minute.
Literally, I had to come out. And for 4 years, I mean, you can imagine how difficult it gets. You know,
I mean, how many things can you do in a minute? It's incredible. And you managed to do that every day?
Yeah, every day. Well, anyway, it was pre-recorded as it goes. But
wow.
But yeah, I think that really sort of put me on the map and really helped my career.
Wow. Okay.
But I think the big thing for me was I started a restaurant called Rist and Theatre down in the Cape on the Winelands.
Oh, okay. Who hasn't heard of that?
And you know, that was huge, and that was almost a culmination of everything that I'd sort of done over the last sort of 15 years. You know, I did everything from outside catering to industrial catering. I mean, literally, we had a company, myself and my business partner, had a company that made all the Spur desserts, for instance.
Wow.
Like, literally every single malva pudding that was served at Spur,
But that's good
made.
Business, right? I mean,
incredible
just in terms
business.
Of numbers.
No,
you, you
I mean,
know,
it's daft.
That's incredible.
The margins are small, but it was really good. And anyway, I had a chef school, and I worked in restaurants and done various things. But the Rest and Feeder was sort of, as I said, a bit of a culmination of everything.
Now, David...
I'm hearing very good things, but Chico the Clowns were there in there as well.
Shut it.
I remember those Chico the Clown ice cream.
We had a big problem with that. They kept melting.
Yeah, you produce them 3 days in advance. It doesn't work so well. But David, it's really hard to be in the chef game for a start, but to be a celebrity chef, and I use the inverted commas because a lot of people are consumed with the fact that they're going to be famous for their food, for their cooking, for their kind of offering. And it's very difficult to break through the noise because there are so many people competing in this environment internationally and locally.
Yeah.
So to get ahead in food is tough as nails.
Yeah. And it's exactly what you said. You know, celebrity chef, I'm not always fond of that title. You know, I'm a chef. I've worked bloody hard to get where I have, and and the whole celebrity thing is sometimes takes sort of the wrong connotation.
It's a poison chalice because people have huge expectations then, and you have to keep on outdoing yourself, which just becomes exhausting.
Yeah, but I think that's exactly it. It's you keep on outdoing it, and you just keep pushing yourself to that next sort of level. And what is out there, and what is? But you know, I've got to a stage now where I just really want to enjoy myself, you know, and I'm very fortunate to be in that position. I've got a great business partner. We're doing something really special in Rosebank. And
who's that? And, give them some credit.
Gary Kiriakou is a guy who walked into my office about a year ago and said to me at the Saxon, I was sitting there, and he walked into my office and said, "Listen, I've got a plan." And I said, "Yeah, sure, you know, shoot." And he showed me this presentation of what he wanted to do. And that's what we're busy with at Marble in Rosebank.
It's called Marble.
It's called Marble, yeah.
Very, very nice. Sounds terrific.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff are you going to make there?
Essentially, the basis of Marble is everything is cooked on fire, proper wood fires. And, you know, if you look at food over the last couple of years, the last 15 years specifically, it's gone that whole sort of molecular way. You know, so all of these fancy bits and things.
It becomes like chemical laboratory stuff, right?
Exactly, and things exploding on plates and dropping out of ceilings and everything else. And and I think, you know, if you look at products,
setting your customers on fire,
yeah, accidentally. Yeah. But if you look at what's happened with it's gone almost back to product. Product is very important in sourcing product, and the whole cooking process is almost also just reverted back to the real thing, you know. So cooking on fire. I've recently travelled to New York and to Sydney, specifically to have a look at what's sort of going on.
Uh-huh.
And the trend there, I promise you, every second restaurant is cooking on fire. And it's crazy that we don't do it yet at a sophisticated level, you know. So I think that's what we're trying to do.
I mean, and South Africans love cooking on a fire. It's probably the one thing out of everything that makes South Africans stick together. We can all agree on one thing, and that is that we like to cook on fires.
And I love the fact that you said that, because yeah, I think the question I get asked the most by international travelers and everything else is, what is South African cuisine? And it's a tricky one, and I hate saying bobotie and malva puddings. You know what I mean? It's because it's not really what we are.
Who knows?
Exactly. But the one thing that we do, you know, across the color lines is we love meat. We love cooking on fire. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Sounds great. All right. So this is a new thing for you then, to start this restaurant of your own, on your own, basically.
Yeah. Look, I've had restaurants before, down in the Cape.
Wrist and Frieda and everything. But
that wasn't
those,
mine.
And that wasn't yours?
No. That belonged to Jean Engelbrecht. But before that, I had my catering companies and restaurants and so forth. But you know, those were all sort of small, quirky sort of things that you sort of do by yourself. And you know, they're not, when you start talking about a 200-300 seater restaurant.
Sure.
You know, it's a different kettle of fish completely.
That's a lot of food to prepare for people.
And cooking on fire. So it's not switch on, switch off. You know, it's not, you know, you've got to sort of negotiate the wood.
Tell me, how much of this is business and how much of it is actually being in the kitchen? Because I would imagine a name like yours is sufficient to launch a place and to get the menu sorted out and all the rest. But I don't think you'd actually spend a lot of time cooking food, right?
I think the reason why I've been lucky to be where I am is because I do spend a lot of time in the kitchen.
Really?
Yeah. And I think it's key.
Beneath you? I mean, I'm not trying to be funny about this.
No,
but
not at all.
With all the experience you had, aren't you tired of the kitchen?
No.
Really?
No. I've tried other things and I haven't been that successful. I tried to manage a wine estate once.
Wow.
That lasted about 9 months. And and I was asked to leave. So, yeah, you know, so I find myself back in the kitchen. That's how it goes.
And most of us, either there are two camps. Most people either fall into the one camp where they absolutely love preparing food, and it feels like it's almost a devotion.
Yeah.
And then there are those people who just hate being in the kitchen. They think of it as routine and dull and dreary. And even when they're being creative, it's really just to produce food for hungry humans, and it's sort of unsatisfying in some way. Now, are there people in between who you can appeal to as well? Because as far as I can tell, everybody likes the taste of good food. It's just that not everybody likes to know how it's prepared. They just are either into it or they're not.
Yeah. Yeah. And the same goes for chefs, you know. You can just see, and I think that's how you gauge the sort of level of success of people, you know. There's a lot of chefs out there that actually don't enjoy being in the kitchen, and you can pick it up straight away. You can pick it up in the food, you know, when you eat the food. And especially myself, I'm quite critical when I go out, and especially when I'm paying money for it.
Yeah.
So that pisses me off sometimes, you know. I mean, you want to feel sort of what's happening in a restaurant. You feel the vibe.
Uh-huh.
And
how do you create that? Because it's not just about the food.
No, it's not about – and it's become very experiential. You know, if you look at restaurants now, it's got to be more than just food. There's no way. And I think that's what Marble – that's really what we're aiming with Marble. Fire is an incredible thing. You know, it's got a mind of its own, and it's very – it touches all the senses. You know, you can smell, you can see the crackle. And I think when you come there, you'll sort of get a real feel for what fire does for a restaurant. But just to get back to the experiential, you know – I think one of the biggest mistakes that restaurants make, you know, talking like an expert, yeah. You know, you are.
Yeah. You're way more expert than me.
No. But I think when you walk into a restaurant, sometimes there's a huge disconnect between front of house and back of house. You know, you look at the menu, you walk in, it's quite glamorous, quite lekker. And then you look at the menu and you say, okay, well, this seems a bit odd. And then when the food comes, there's just complete disconnect. And I think that's really what we're trying to create here is we have a complete open plan kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
The chefs can really feel part of the room of what's going on. Those days of chefs being behind closed doors and for various reasons, behind closed doors and can't get a feel for the restaurants are really over. You know, we really need to.
Also, I think people are suspicious of like a restaurant that keeps everything hidden away now. It used to be that that was where the food was prepared and it had nothing to do with you. But now I think people like to see that. And they also like to know that everything's being done, you know, sort of in a kosher way.
No, absolutely.
that there isn't, someone isn't dropping steaks on the floor and then throwing them at you.
Yeah. And that does, I mean, I'll never ever forget my first job. I worked as a breakfast chef at the Tilburg Hotel. It was a three-star hotel down on the foreshore in Cape Town. And on Sundays there was a carvery. And because I was the youngest in the kitchen and didn't really know what I'm doing, they put me out on the carvery in front of everybody because nobody really wanted to come out of the kitchen. My head chef used to smoke dope under the extractor fan. I mean, literally. So he used to like send me out there. His name was Victor Lyons. Interesting character. Anyway, so... And I mean, the stories, I can just tell you, Gareth, you're sort of running out of chickens and there's whole frozen chickens going into chip fryers. And there's, I mean, the.
Oh, wow.
But you think as a youngster, as an 18, 19 year old, you think you've arrived. I mean, it's absolute chaos, you know, yeah. But it's absolute, it's cowboy antics, you know, it's
right.
Crazy.
But it's exciting.
But yes, yeah. It grabs you. And I thought I'd arrived, you know, I thought, this is my life. I mean, as you say, you know, chickens, whole chickens on floors, as you're carving, you know, you lose a whole sirloin accidentally, you know, that's ridiculous. But yeah, the open kitchen gives a little bit of theatre. People sort of feel part of what's going on, and it integrates the whole sort of front of house and back of house, and gives the customer, on client or guest, an added experience.
I mean, Mubs, Ben, do you like seeing what goes on in the kitchen?
It depends where you're eating. If it's somewhere fancy, definitely. Because you know it's cool things with really, like, you know, qualified people.
Yeah.
Somewhere not so fancy, just bring it.
Yeah.
Somewhere not so fancy, hide it. Don't even show me that stuff. Do you like to see it, Mavs?
I'm indifferent. Doesn't matter.
But I think if there's a show, then it's pretty cool. I mean, if there's a bit of action going on, or not really.
Well, I've never experienced that, so maybe I should.
Okay.
Yeah.
My buddy's usually tongue deep in the man opposite her.
Tongue deep in a bottle in. But yeah, if you go to this cool place and you see the fire, it's like really exciting, right? You go somewhere cheap and you see a fire, you think, oh, shit.
Oh, the place is on fire, yeah.
Good point.
You get out of here. The place is on fire. Yes, Flax?
I like those restaurants with like that open kitchen or has like a glass that you can see directly into the kitchen. I feel it's my right. To see how my food is prepared.
My right.
Okay.
Yep. You're going to collect Pokemons while you're in the restaurant?
I'm sure there's the Pikachus probably sitting at the Saxon.
All right, let me ask you something. When you prepare food for a cycling team, that has got to be the most... First of all, it's strict as all hell. I mean, you know you've got to keep calories down, and these people are probably really precious about what they eat in their stupid bicycles. And you have to cook up stuff that isn't always exciting, but it has to be nutritious and lean and blah blah blah, and you know, these are single-minded people very often. Isn't that one of the worst jobs that a chef could hope for?
Well, I'm a cyclist. I know. Let's not get into this. But
oh,
I
knew, no. Get out of here.
I knew that was coming. Anyway, so moving on swiftly.
No, okay. So you have some understanding of what they.
Exactly. I about 3 years ago, I got into a really sort of active sort of training regime, and I lost about 20 kilos in 8 months, training for a specific race.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a real understanding of what it takes and what is necessary. Anyway, I was invited along by Dougie Ryder to come and cook for the boys on the first Tour de France. And the first thing I just want to say is that the boys really, you know, no egos. You know,
oh, really?
No, no.
Okay,
egos.
Good. Okay, that's nice.
Because
then it makes your job easier.
100%. I mean, probably that was probably one of my biggest challenges. I think was just settling it down with the guys and making sure that everybody was covered from a dietary point of view. And the guys just said, you know, just do your thing. I think what you got to understand is the one thing that these guys have to look forward to. I mean, you look at yesterday. I don't know if you saw yesterday's stage, but the guys finished in hail. Literally, they started in 30 degree plus temperatures after 180 kilometers. They finished in hail. And you get, you know, it's unpleasant. So the only thing that these guys have got to look forward to is their massage and their food.
Yeah.
And that made it easy for me.
Because they're not taking in the scenery like we are, right?
No, we don't want to know where the next church is. And
they are supremely focused.
Yeah. So it actually made my job pretty easy. I cooked home-cooked food, but I did it in a healthy sort of way. You know, instead of using sugars, we used agave syrups and honeys and that kind of thing, and not too much of it. And so we varied things along. It really was pretty simple. My major role there was really just was exactly that. It was almost not a motivational role, but it was, as I said, it was one thing that they had to look forward to. And
yeah.
I would chat to the guys, and I'm from South Africa. A lot of the South African boys was their first Tour de France. They were away from home for 9 months. I could speak Afrikaans to a couple of them. So it was also, you underestimate your sort of role, you know, and if it's been a long day and it's really hot, some of the days are 45 degrees, the guys were coming back. We prepared lovely smoothies for them, you know, with whatever product we could find on the day. So no, I, the whole experience for me was quite incredible, and it was key. You know, I mean, feeding the guys is, as you can imagine, is key. The biggest challenge was every day you moved to a new kitchen, and you had to deal with some French prat who was either pissed at 10 o'clock in the morning, who didn't want to speak to you, didn't want to speak to you in English for a start.
French think they know everything about food, right?
And especially cycling. Everything. I mean, you can imagine the combination.
Yeah.
I mean, I was lost before I started. You know, I was done.
They didn't like one thing about you.
No. So it was.
Was a lot of the time, did you have sort of preset meals that you kind of planned and thought you would do, only to then find you couldn't get ingredients? Was like difficult like that?
Well, I tried that. I've tried that for the first 3 days. So the first, I had my whole sort of trip planned, and you know, all these great ideas. And anyway, so eventually it became a sort of run into the closest decent supermarket and health store, see what's on the shelf, and that was it. Literally every day was like that. You're running. You know,
sounds like Survivor, not like the Tour de France.
Amazing Race, Chef Edition.
So that was it. You know, just find what's fresh. You got to be so careful of you know, like hormones in meats and stuff. So you had to try and get as much organic stuff as possible.
Wow, yeah, of course.
Because you can't feed this guy. Because a couple of years back, I mean, Ben, you know.
Sure, there were
some of the guys were saying, "Yeah, they ate some meat with some, you know, hormones in, you know."
So they were busting everybody for whatever was going on, even if they didn't know they had stuff in their food.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway. But it was. Let me just tell you what an incredible experience to, I mean, what the guys go through. And you know, you think it's quite glamorous on the TVs and everything else. Those guys come back and they sleep in 1-star hotels, you know, because the tour is too big. It's 2,500 vehicles.
Yeah, you can't accommodate everybody.
You'd gridlock a city. So basically, everybody slept in airports and industrial areas, because the only place where the buses and stuff could park. No air conditioning in the rooms. The beds were, I mean, literally, it's ridiculous. The beds were probably 30, 40 years old, you know.
And, but then it's like that most teams, or was Team Sky, they.
No.
They're still in there.
So Team Sky, last year bought 11, camper vans.
Yeah.
Like down to the, and they weren't allowed to use them. So what they said is that it works on a rotational sort of basis. So if you get a bad hotel the one day, you try and get to a better hotel, but the better hotel is like from a 1-star to a 2-star. So they do try and balance it out.
French people who run
some
them.
Moth-eaten sheet.
Yeah.
And they probably only see people at Tour de France time, because there's some parts of the tour that, there's no reason to be in France at that particular place at that time.
Yeah, and especially not in an industrial area. You know.
Jeez, that sounds horrible.
Wow, I was in the impression these guys were just... So they had these amazing trailer RV things, and then what?
So the management slept in them.
Jeez, that doesn't sound right. Huh?
No wonder they all look so like weather-beaten and really mean in that race.
And unhappy. Yeah. Well... to me, it's also exciting. I mean, you represented South Africa at the Culinary World Cup in Switzerland and the Culinary Olympics in Germany. But the pressure must be enormous there, because it's down to someone's opinion, effectively, or a panel of people's opinion. You feel like you're on that stupid MasterChef, you know?
Well, let's go further. You think you're on some other foodie blog, or, you know.
Yeah.
Let me not get into that, because I think that's one of our biggest hates.
Isn't it horrible? Because people on a food blog can these days, they have such power they shouldn't have.
No, Gareth, I tell you, if there's something that irks me, it's
they've become the new critics, right?
100%.
And at least the critics...
Journalists, you know.
At least the critics had to have some kind of track record and credibility.
Yep.
A blogger could be anybody, any loser from anywhere, and if they have a shitty meal once...
Yep.
They'll write the most horrible things about you. There's just nothing you can do.
But the shitty meal is their opinion. At least when it comes to a food critic, the guy's giving you technical sort of, I've burnt the food, I've oversalted, I've overdone this.
Sure, he has some idea of what he's
talking
about.
Because you don't like pumpkin with pecan nuts, you know what I mean? You know, I don't know why the chef has done this combination or done, you know, that's your opinion, mate. I don't really care for your opinion.
Have you heard of Yelp?
Yeah.
In America, it's a big deal.
Such a great South Park episode about that everyone in the town becomes Yelpers.
Yeah.
So much so that the restaurants then revolt and there's this massive war.
Yeah.
But how much has it changed? I mean, first of all, let me ask you about ingredients, because that's something that's become very different. And there never were this many ingredients in restaurants 50 years ago.
Yeah.
There's no way. Like, now you can get anything all year round if you're prepared to pay for it.
Yeah.
People are putting... strange combinations of food together that sometimes work, sometimes don't. But you can effectively get anything, which not only makes it difficult for you to buy the stock that you need and actually use it before it goes off,
yeah,
but it also means that people have very high expectations.
Yeah.
How does that complicate just doing really good meals?
Well, this is where you've got to be very, very careful. And it was one of the things, funny that you say that, because it was one of the things when I came from Rissenfrieda, where I could be quite adventurous with the food. And then I got to the Saxon with 500, we started then. And,
yeah, the restaurant was called 500.
Yeah, yeah. I had to be very careful with the combinations. You know, people just didn't want sort of, white anchovy with dark chocolate. You know what I mean? So
in other words, are you saying that, no, but I mean, yeah. Is there a difference between the Cape Town palate or the Winelands palate and the palate of a Joburg?
Yeah, I think the Cape Town palate is quite open. Again, there's a lot of chefs doing a lot of things. So everybody was sort of used to these sort of interesting combinations that were going around. And yeah, so
they were a little more experimental.
And when I got to Joburg, you know, because not a lot of people were doing it, there was a lot of sort of
resistance
to it, for sure.
So are you saying Joburg people, not as interesting from a culinary point of view?
No, tell the truth. No. Let's not get into that conversation.
No, come on.
No. I just think that because the Cape Town folk were exposed to it more, they were a little bit more open to it. It's definitely changing in Joburg. There's a restaurant down at the sheds called Urbanology. They're doing a lot of stuff. DW11 is doing quite a lot of stuff. All of a sudden, there's a lot of interesting things sort of going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it is definitely changing, and that's great to see. But also, you know, not everybody wants the weird and wonderful combinations. Some people just want really well-cooked food, and I think there's a market for that too, because there's a whole lot of crap around as well, you know.
And do you agree less is more? I mean, sometimes you only need a couple of ingredients to make some good stuff.
Well, that's exactly why I'm doing what I'm doing, you know. And just to talk about ingredients, you know, I started cooking in 1989 It was all about iceberg lettuce, curly leaf parsley and tomato roses. I don't even remember if you used to peel a tomato and make a rose with curly parsley on the side and iceberg lettuce. And that was really what was available. Now we can probably get 56 different varietals of lettuce. You know, I mean, I don't know what we do with them. They don't taste like anything, but you know, they're there. They're available. So, it has, the change has been interesting.
But Dave, what kind of stuff are you cooking at home for yourself though? Because, I mean, your life is about all of this, and you could tell us about 50 bloody shades of lettuce.
Like last night. Did you go out last night, or were you at home?
I was at a mate's engagement party last night, so they had a quite a big Jewish spread there. I'm a huge fan of gnocchi. For gnocchi and pesto would be my ultimate meal. I sit home and eat. But I'm very much about mood as well. When it comes to food and drink, it just depends on my mood. I love a braai, obviously. I mean, that's shellfish on a braai is like one of those things that you almost can't get better. You know, it's a bit snobbish, but it is. It's just one of those special things. But well matured meat on a fire is great. But again, and breakfast, I could eat breakfast all day.
Really,
yes. That is the best.
Literally, bacon and egg. I could eat it when I get home at night. You know, so,
I don't think you'll have any fight from anyone there.
Yeah, exactly.
David, I want to know, in March of 2013, Justin Bieber stayed at the Saxon. Did you cook for him?
Yeah, I
happened. You did?
Yeah.
You've just made flex.
What was his favorite meal?
You know what? It was so insignificant, I can't even remember. He ate very simply.
He just ruined his day.
He made ours, though.
No, he did. It wasn't particularly healthy. It was sort of takeaway. We had to get some takeaways and pizzas.
What takeaways? I need specifics.
He enjoyed Nando's. I think everybody enjoys Nando's.
Everyone
actually
loves Nando's.
Yeah, exactly. So that was, I think that was one of the hits, but yeah. Wasn't really.
Did you meet him though?
No.
Did you want to? You didn't care.
Not really. No.
Have you ever delivered food to someone's room and you open up the door and you're like, oh, Prince Charles?
The nanny. Fran Drescher.
Did she say, cool.
Oh my God, that's such great food.
I had to go and chat to her about her meal, but she's pretty cool. Yeah.
So she was talkative. See, a lot of people don't know how to deal with the chef because the chef's really important. He's like management at the hotel.
Yeah.
He's not the waiter. He's not the guy who's doing a lot of the rudimentary stuff in the kitchen. So a lot of people aren't sure whether it's appropriate to say, you know, compliments to the chef, or whether it's appropriate to have, when the chef comes over, to have a conversation with him or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
There's a whole etiquette involved.
No, absolutely. And it is very important to us. We really do enjoy the interaction. And And especially when guests arrive at hotels, it's really important to talk to them. You know, especially the we know who's fussy and who's not fussy, and you need to sort all those things out before the shit starts. Really,
what's the worst kind of customer you have at either a restaurant or a hotel or anything like that? Who are the and you don't have to mention names, but explain the kind of people, because there's a certain type of person who's just, you can tell when they come in they're a problem, right?
Yeah, I mean it's
describe
really
that
if you know if you know the industry and the restaurant industry, you'll pick it up when people walk through the door.
What do you look
and the
for?
The issue there is, let me just start at the front. You know, it could be the security guard that upset him before he walked through the door. He couldn't find parking. You know, it's all these sort of things. You've had a bad day. You know, you've got stuck in traffic. So the guy walks through the door and immediately is edgy. He's, you know, he doesn't like the table he sat at. You know, well, you know, all the other tables, literally the restaurant's full. There's one table left. It's the table that he's booked, unfortunately. And now he's throwing a scene because he wants to sit somewhere else. But what do you want me to do?
And
honestly,
you just
just carries on and on and on. And the next thing, it's the Persian carpet that doesn't go with the interiors. You know what I mean?
You've had people do that?
I've had, you know, there's that whole opinion thing. You know, this Persian carpet really doesn't go with this room.
Then, but have you ever told anyone, look, we'll just leave then?
I've only asked someone to leave once.
How did that happen? Tell me that story.
Well, basically, it was one of these situations where nothing was good enough, you know, and eventually you just say, look, you know, nothing that I do tonight. And he was actually, you know what? He was a hotelier. He was a manager at a hotel in Cape Town. Can you believe that? And this was at Bristol Theatre. It's not a half-assed restaurant.
You'd think this guy would have some kind of sympathy for you. Not at all, huh?
Nothing. And he had a go after go. And then, you know, the biggest cowards are those that start having a go at your staff. They don't want to talk to the management or whatever. They want to have a go at the staff. And when you walk up to the table, then everything's okay.
Imagine working for this guy. It must be hell. So did you come up to the table and say to him, look, dude, thanks very much for coming. Yeah. I need you to go.
Enough is enough, you know. And we're obviously not going to please you tonight, and it's not going to work. So, you know,
fuck off.
That's it. Yeah, you know, basically, in a nice way.
Wow. Okay. That's not. It's not all fun and games.
No. Look, I mean, and I think that's my biggest fear. I've generally been involved with small restaurants, you know, 20, 30 seaters, 40 seaters mainly. So when it comes to 200 seaters, I think my biggest fear is firstly the social media. You know, as good as it is, it can kill you in a day. And I'm very aware of that.
Does it make you paranoid?
Yeah, it does make me paranoid. And you know what I've ended up doing is actually not reading things like TripAdvisor, not going to all the eat-out sites and so forth. I actually avoid them because it upset me.
The only time I look at them is to find out the address of the place.
Yeah, exactly.
I could care less for other people's reviews of food.
Yeah.
How are they going to know what works for you and how you – everything's so subjective.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of my biggest fears. And then the other thing is just – you know, it's on a daily. I can see, you know, on a daily basis, just dealing with difficult situations. But so yeah, that's part of the game.
Who do you rate in terms of famous chefs all over the world? Who do you reckon are the best, and who do you think have all these reputational quirks, but they aren't necessarily that good? Just give me a couple of people you do admire.
Let me just tell you something about Gordon Ramsay, for instance. You know, Gordon Ramsay is a renter and a raver, and you know, and he's sort of put himself across that way.
He's a showman.
He's quite a chef, but he's a bloody good chef. Let me just tell you, you know, and I don't particularly like him. I've met him a few times, and you know, he's not a particularly nice guy, but he is incredibly good at what he does. And he's a three-star Michelin chef. You don't just get three-star Michelins and or three Michelin stars. It's you know, you got to be pretty talented to be able to do that. So you know, for what he's done, you look at the Jamie Olivers of the world. You know, as much as we hate him as an individual, you know, but he's done incredible things for chefs. He's brought the chefs out of the kitchens. He's given us a bit of a persona. We you know, people now demand to see the chefs. You know, in a good way. You know, they really want to interact with us. And I guess these guys have done a hell of a lot for us. Again, as I said in the beginning, we were behind closed doors and there was a shouting and screaming going on, pots and pans being thrown around, and now it's all these open kitchens where you've got to be ready. Really careful and sort of, you know, become a bit of a personality as well, you know, engaging with guests. And
don't you think that the customer has too much say these days? The customer wants to have banting food, they want to have paleo food, they want to be vegan, they want to be vegetarian, they want to be pescatarian. They have too much say.
Yeah.
You should say, this is the kind of food we do at our restaurant. If you don't like it, piss off. Go somewhere else. There's got to be something else for you somewhere.
Well, look, that's because some idiot told them that the customer is always right, and then it all went to our heads.
Yeah. Look, I think the dietary requirements one of your worst nightmares, and especially with big tables. You know, you get a table of 10 and there's six dietary requirements. You know, we don't eat this, we don't eat that, we don't eat starch. And I guess that, you know, you sort of learn to deal with it. But I think when you start covering everything on your menu, when you're sort of designing your menu and you sort of make sure that there's something for everybody, it becomes relatively easy.
But you do get, like, you'll get a table sometimes and everybody at that table has some particular thing. They're allergic to this. They can't eat that. This must be halal. That must be kosher. This can't contain fish. This can't contain bread. These people make it so hard for everyone to just have a fun night out because of their crappy dietary requirements.
Yeah. You must try and be in the kitchen. You must actually join me in the kitchen one day. And, when those orders come in, you must see how frustrating it is. You've got a full restaurant. You literally have a full restaurant.
Yeah.
And you get this page of dietary requirements, you know, with no warning. You know, when people place, when they make reservations, you know, we always ask, you know, are there any dietaries and everything else? And yeah, no. It's too casual. And when they come in, then all of this hits you. And to try and fix that in a full restaurant, it's a flippin' nightmare. And it affects everybody around you. It's exactly what you said. It affects everybody around you.
No, if you've got 100 dietary requirements, stay at home.
Yeah.
You've got to make your own food.
Yeah.
Really, you can't complicate everyone else's life. Mubs, what is our rule?
Don't make your problems everybody else's problem.
So that's our rule.
But what do you think is like the most, you get like fads and trends and all that kind of crap. What's been the most sort of annoying and in your mind, the most just non-rational kind of thing? You can say banting.
Say whatever you like. You don't have to protect anybody here.
No, I think, you know, I don't want to say this. Gluten-free has always been a...
I was about to say, that's my pet peeve.
Some bullshit, right?
Yeah. I have a very dear friend who I know it plays havoc on her intestines. You know? I mean, there are people. But every second person is gluten-free, you know? I mean, it's absolute bollocks, you know? And it really does affect what you put on the plate, you know? It really does... It changes the meal, you know? So gluten-free is something that I just feel is just over...
We had this chat on Friday in the open office here. It's like talking about, you know, when's the last time someone said, you know, my health is so bad, I think I'm really just, the gluten's killing me, or I died last week because of gluten.
Died. Well, if they died, they wouldn't be.
Yeah.
But it is one of those things that people, okay, you get the odd case, just like you get people who have thyroid issues, that's why they're overweight. It's very slim.
Yeah.
But sorry, it's very few in numbers. But, you know, people, it's like such a fashionable thing to say nowadays, well, I'll only have it if it's gluten free.
Yeah.
But what's the gluten going to do to you?
And the other thing is just don't eat it. If the plate comes, just push it aside. You know what I mean?
But half of these people won't even be able to tell you what gluten is.
Well, there you go. There's nothing. Because sometimes it does, you know, you have a slip and they eat, you see the plate comes back and it's all being eaten.
I think it's everybody wants to be special. You know, they just want to, they want a little bit of attention. They want everyone at the table to go, ooh, you don't eat gluten. How
what
exciting
informed,
for you.
Sarah, informed choice.
Sarah, we thought you were so boring before, but now that you mentioned the gluten, we're just blown away by how exciting you are to be around.
Wow,
tell us more about your eating problems.
You look exactly the same, but your choices, wow.
Sarah, you've just blown me away. What is this kale? What is that? What is kale?
Kale is a leafy vegetable. The Portuguese. Hey, Portuguese.
Oh, yeah, well done to the Portuguese. don't worry.
Do we get it in South Africa?
Don't you worry. That's coming up next. They'll have that on the Vola Football Show for Euro. I see that they've got lots to talk about. They've got people here in Portuguese kit, everything. It's going to be very exciting. So don't miss the football show coming up next. Voila, Euro 2016. That's with Stefano and Vivian, that's next. But back to kale. So what is kale?
So kale is a leafy vegetable, not unlike cabbage, but quite bitter. And
it tastes like bug spray.
Yeah, basically. And but when you start mixing it with things like chorizos
have you ever tasted your deodorant, Mubs?
No, why would I?
Well, maybe you sprayed the deodorant on and somewhere in your mouth. That's how it tastes. That's how kale tastes, and people think it's fucking
fantastic. Now
explain
the bug spray. How did you end up tasting bug spray?
No, I didn't.
I grew up on a farm.
I assume DDT in its pure form tastes just like kale.
Yeah, when you add other things to it, it really it comes to life.
What, this is a fashion fad, right? This is not something that should be part of anyone's dietary requirements.
Yeah, it's like cabbage juice, you know. I mean, why would you drink cabbage? Yeah, why would you do that, you know? So,
what's the worst thing you've ever made that people wanted it even though you knew it was bullshit?
Yeah, cabbage juice.
Cabbage juice.
Yeah, yeah. Have you smelled this? I mean, it's quite interesting. Cabbage. Yeah, when you work at hotels, especially you know you get lists when the sort of the VIPs check in. Yeah. They have their requirements.
Their riders.
Yeah. And in those riders, there's always a vegetable, a juice, a fresh juice, you know, and I mean, whether, you know, it's obviously all the norm, but cabbage juice was definitely one of the top list. Can you imagine the after effects of that?
Disgusting. You know, you must just open up on both sides.
Gassy.
Yeah, gas. How horrible. What's the most expensive ingredient you have to add regularly to meals?
On a regular basis.
Or even exceptionally. Most crazy price for one kind of ingredient.
Look, I think truffles are probably
what do truffles cost?
So truffles, I think the last time I checked...
They still dig those out with a pig in the forest,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, pigs or the dogs, yeah. So so the truffles, the last price I saw was, I think, 26,000 rand a kilo for the black truffle, and then it's about 150,000 rand a kilo for the white truffle.
150,000 rand a kilo?
A kilo, yeah.
So why?
If I come to a restaurant and you've prepared truffles for me, I assume in some kind of dessert or something.
No. It generally goes with things like risottos and
so I'm ordering
meat dishes.
I'm ordering a risotto and it's got some truffle in it. What does that do to the price?
So a normal risotto costs about 3.50 to make, you know, and a good portion. I mean, we're talking about rice and, you know, so 3.50. So all of a sudden, the dish becomes 3,500 rand because you've put 2 grams of truffle onto it. I mean, it literally is that ridiculous.
And does it make that much of a difference to the taste?
You know what? I'm gonna go with yeah, it does. It's
really,
it's quite an ingredient. I mean, there's
what
nothing,
does it taste like? I've never had truffles in anything.
Yeah. It tastes like old shoes, really, but a special old shoe. You know, it's like
okay.
Like the soul of a really
3,500 rand for an old shoe taste. This is great.
No, I'm teasing. No. The one thing with truffle is that you can't replicate the flavor. You know, it is what it is. It's very specific and I can't believe
that price, 150,000 rand for a kilogram.
No, well, that's why you just don't get white truffle. Yeah, you know, it's just too expensive. The black truffle you still get and so forth. So yeah. So it's pretty.
And how do you even put that in? Do you shave off tiny little bits?
So basically, you get a special truffle shaver. Obviously, at that price, it comes with a shaver. And you just thin slivers. And I think it comes out about 0.5 gram at a time. You know, that's what it's supposed to do. But yeah.
That's incredible. Is there anything else that comes close?
No. Yeah, caviar, I suppose. You know, when you're starting adding proper caviar to dishes, that's about, I think those tubs are about, for proper beluga, is probably about 50,000 rand for. What is it, about a 300 grand tub? I mean, you know, it's
expensive.
It's a proper amount of money.
And are there seasonings and certain kinds of things that you, herbs and spices and additives and things that you can add in that would be very expensive too?
Not really. I think when it comes to you know, things like oils are expensive. You know, there's in North Africa, they have the argan, you know, argan oils and things like that. And they're very, very specific flavor. You can't really explain. So you have to get quite specific and quite sort of almost territorial to get the really expensive products. But anyway.
What are some of the strangest delicacies you've experienced, like bull's testicles or whatever?
Yeah, testicles is not bad. Standard practice. Yeah, bulls, great. It tastes very much like liver, same sort of textures and so forth. Crispy scorpion, overrated.
That sounds good.
Yeah, it's like the Mapani worms. You know, it's really
dust.
Yeah, exactly.
Mapani worms taste like dust.
Yeah,
I explained this to someone once because we had to eat them as like a dare once, and I had one, and it was just like eating a handful of dust.
Yeah.
Sand.
But then I think things things that are not so exotic, but things like fish heads, incredible flavor. You know, a fish head in the cheeks and the eyes. You know, it's just great flavor.
Bashita, would you eat that stuff?
Mapani worms.
Yeah,
I used to eat them all the time at my grandma's place.
You liked them?
That was a delicacy.
You liked them?
Love them.
Were they all dry as well?
Well, some of them are dry.
Some of them are a bit wet. It depends on when you pick them.
Oh, juicy.
Oh, my God.
She's always so happy.
Yeah, she is. She doesn't even mind
us. She's never had a bad day her entire life.
Cindy on WeChat says, what about saffron?
Yeah, saffron, of course. So saffron is the stamen of a crocus. So it's a flower. And they get hand-picked. Literally, guys climb cliffs and pick these flowers and these little stamen then get in. You, I mean, you know what saffron is? It gives that beautiful color. Paella is probably the most common form. It gives that beautiful deep yellow color. But the flavor is very specific. You don't get anything like, and that's what I'm saying about these very specific, like from areas, and they give very specific flavors. So yeah. Wow.
Okay. Have you ever dealt with customers who try to show off and to try to prove that they could possibly know as much as you, even though they're not a chef?
Is that the worst?
You know what,
those pretentious assholes.
When it comes to wine, so I mean, not only, I mean, wine pairings for me has become one of the most overrated things. You know, people trying to force, you know, this Syrah has to go with this sort of smoked oxtail. You know what I mean? We all have our palettes, and everybody's different. Everybody's makeup is different. We like different things. So don't tell me that this Syrah has to go
wrong. Yeah,
for sure. So you know, I'm really quite desperate to move away from all of that, which is exactly the reason why I'm sort of moving in the direction that I am.
David,
but yo,
why?
Oi, Flex.
Oh, did I disturb you? Sorry.
He was just busy answering something.
That's okay.
Michael, he didn't care about Bieber. Just forget about that. He just didn't care about him.
If this is a Bieber question, then I'm going to chase you out.
I really want to know, why is caviar so expensive when don't fish have like thousands and thousands of eggs in them?
But it's a specific kind of fish that you only find in a specific kind of place.
Yeah, it's a sturgeon. And I mean, although they carry kilos of eggs, you know, it's from you know, either the Baltic Sea or very specific regions. Again, very sort of region territorial. Hard to farm and hard to find. I guess that's what throws the price, you know.
Okay.
But anyway, about difficult customers.
Yeah.
People's opinions on wine. And that's why you've got to brief your staff so well, you know, because so your wine steward or your sommelier or whatever goes up to the table and suggests a wine and some oak starts mouthing off about, and he's talking about an Italian wine. And he's talking about a French region, from a French region. So you know that he's talking absolute nonsense. You know, but there's no way that
can you say to him,
oi, but those are the best.
Don't you enjoy putting them in their place and saying to them, oh, you're a douche, because that's not from France.
It's so difficult when it's your own place. You know, when you're sitting at a table with other people, when you've been invited, that's my best, you know, because then nobody knows you're a chef.
Yeah.
So some oaks mouthing off's my best. So you're at a table of 10, we're going out, you know, people that I don't really know that well, or, you know, I'm not great at that anyway. But anyway, so hypothetically, I'll go out and some oak starts mouthing off about, you know, the free range cattle from the Free State or whatever, you know, and then you sort of pipe up from the side, you know, and that must feel
good. But then at the same time, it must be very, very intimidating for anyone else when you walk into their restaurant. If they do recognize you, then they go, oh my God, there's that David Higgs. He's gonna find something wrong with us.
I'm not overcritical when I eat at restaurants. I'd kill myself if I do. You know, so I just I think the difficult thing is that you don't get invited to too many people's houses. To be honest.
Oh really?
Yeah.
That's a good point, because if I had to have you around to my house, I'd be shitting myself about what to make.
Yeah, so that's a bit of a bummer. So usually people come to my to my place. Although my good mate Dan Nichols has been pretty good.
You know Dan as well.
Yeah. So
what does he eat?
So he eats everything.
A lot.
Daniel's son. Anyway, so he's about the only guy that's not intimidated. He feeds me lots of wine and I end up cooking anyway, so it's fine.
Yeah, all right. Do you think South Africans have a sophisticated palate? I mean, you mentioned Cape Town earlier, and Kala says Rustenfried is like 90% tourists. So it says nothing about the Cape Town palate. Cape Townians, according to him, eat fish and chips or spur. Do you think the South African palate's refined? I mean, the French have this reputation across the world for being extraordinary judges of whether something has culinary quality or not. Yeah. But is that always true?
I think what South Africans like, you know, when it comes to food and brying and and so forth. We love the barbecue spices. We like the chili spices. We like the things that are sweet. We like the things that burn. You know, that's generally the South African palate. And again, it doesn't matter who or what you are. You know, that's really what the South African palate is.
So you're
is.
Saying we're rubes? I mean, really?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, we and I mean, I'm one of them, you know.
Sure.
But slowly but surely, the guys are asking for less of the basting sauces. You know, like my pet ate in a restaurant when you got a really good piece of meat and Oak says, no, you, please just baste
it. Covered it in chutney and
yeah, the basting sauce. Can I,
you got any mushroom sauce? Can, yeah, the, can the
I put,
creamy
can
one.
I could possibly put that on the side for you. No. Anyway, so I think yeah, our palate has definitely changed over the last couple of years, definitely over the last 10 years. But yeah, we're still very fond of our sweet and spicy, you know, and that's why we like Asian food so much, you know, the Chinese and the Japanese foods. I mean, those generally, I mean, they are spicy, they're sweet. Mm. Curries, I love a good curry. So yeah, I think our palates are probably a little bit less refined, but we know what we like, you know. At least we know that.
Yeah.
At least when Oak comes and sits down in the restaurant, right, so, and he says, "I like that." You
know? When is your new restaurant, Marble, opened?
Gareth, that's a good question. We were supposed to be open on the 2nd of March.
Is it going to be in the next month or two? I mean, must we keep an eye on the...
No, I'll certainly let you know. We'll be open, I'm hoping, the first week of August.
Oh, okay.
That's sort of the goal at the moment, and awesome. We're really excited. So we want to give Joburg a lekker experience, and where people can come.
Apart from the fire and the food, what else makes it a little bit different?
It's got incredible views. We got an
Where is it?
It's you know where Circa Art Gallery is?
Yes.
So right next to Circa Art Gallery, the same architects of Circa Art Gallery, Studio Mass, have actually revamped the old Chevron building. There's that Caltex underneath for the BGR.
Right.
So on top of the roof, they've added another deck.
Sounds great.
So, yeah, exciting time. So we've got an incredible bar as well that we'll be serving some tapas in, a nice, quite a swanky little bar.
Sounds great.
So, yeah, looking forward to it.
All right, man. Well, I'll be there. That's David Higgs. Go to Marble, his new restaurant, and what an interesting life of kind of. Have you ever hurt yourself cooking? Burnt yourself badly? Stabbed yourself with a knife?
Yeah, I stabbed myself a few times. That's lost a few nerves. I can't feel anything in this thumb. You know,
oh, really?
Kind of thing. Yeah, that's how it goes.
I once, I'm not a chef, but I once almost sliced my finger off with an avo.
There we go.
Now I just don't cut avos myself. I have someone else cut them for me because I'm useless. Such a child. Mubs, it was hanging by a thread.
Yes, I remember you and Kuli Chana compared fingers after he got shot in the hand.
Yes, that's right.
And my
wound
looked
worse
than his.
Let's remind people.
Jersey is rough.
Damn right. It's very, very dangerous here. All right, thank you to David Higgs. CliffCentral.com.